This is Isabella Morales on June 21st at the Princeton Public Library as part of the Voices of Princeton project. I'm here today with Janet Stern and Doretta Gallucci.
I'm Janet Stern.
And I'm Doretta Gallucci. Janet, can you tell me a little bit about how you came to Princeton, how long you've lived here?
Yes, I came to Princeton because of my husband's job after graduate school, but we've been here 38 years. And when we told people where we came from, that we were coming here, everybody said, be careful, it's a very snobby town. So that was 38 years ago. How about you, Doretta? When did you come?
We came in about 1997. And we came from Baltimore. Mm-hmm. My husband also job transferred here. I was working for an art museum in mm-hmm. Baltimore, and very looking forward to coming to Princeton. I heard nothing but wonderful things about the campus, the university, the culture, the Carter Theater. Mm-hmm. So I was very much looking forward to it.
And we met because I was on the Board of Trustees of the Arts Council of Princeton, and you were hired as the Managing Director probably around 1998 or so.
I think so, 97, 98, right.
And I was on the board because I had another job, but I left that other job to join the Arts Council as the Program Director, so that actually was probably under you, but we worked together.
Right, we were basically co-directors. Right.
I was responsible for all the programs. You were responsible for
internal management. Mm-hmm. So basically, the fundraising and organization and financial stability.
Right.
So, can you tell me a little bit about what, why you think we should tell this particular story?
Yes. I want to tell this story because I think it's an example of how the tendrils of racism keep uncurling. And Princeton, as we know, was a slave town in the 1700s, 1800s. In fact, there was even a slave auction on campus under the two sycamores that are still there. And there was a very big division between the black community and the white community, of course, centering around the college later on. And there was, through the ages, through the centuries, a tremendous antipathy mm-hmm. on the part of the African-American population toward the white population. And it's really important to mention what happened in the development of Palmer Square, because this was totally significant. This was an area called, I think it was Baker Street, but they called it Baker Alley. And these were the houses. This is Palmer Square, and anybody who's listening to this knows that this is the center of town. Palmer Square was Baker Alley, and these were the houses of the African-American residents, of many of them. They owned their houses in large part. Many didn't, but many did. And then Edgar Palmer came in. I think he was a Princeton alum, if I'm not mistaken. He was a developer. He came in 1929, and he decided that this should be Palmer Square. So I mean, I'm jumping ahead here. The people who lived there, who owned houses there, had mortgages. Mm-hmm. The banks told them to go. Mm-hmm. I'm making this very, very general. It's much more complicated. And they didn't know at that time that they didn't have to, and they didn't have money for legal help. So they watched as their houses, if you can believe this, were moved one by one to Birch Avenue, which is now one of the main streets in the John Witherspoon neighborhood. So there's a tremendous anger about that displacement
alone.
In your own town where you have lived, where your ancestors have lived for centuries. Tremendous displacement.
And I think something you shared with me, if you could talk a little bit about, was not only the houses, but that community. It was such an integral part of their lifestyle, and being that there was so much segregation.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about
that? That's where we're coming more toward the present now, because in that neighborhood, there developed a very strong community feeling, and lots of businesses. all kinds of African-American businesses. Why? Because Princeton was segregated. This was about, I would say Edgar Palmer did this in 1929, and so from 1929 until the 50s, at least, this was a segregated town. The schools were segregated. The restaurants were segregated. The institutions were segregated. The stores were segregated. And what I really want to talk about is that the Y was segregated. The Arts Council building on the corner of Witherspoon and Paul Robeson Place, now called Paul Robeson Place, I will tell you, because that had to change. That Arts Council building was built during the WPA era as a community center. For the residents of the John Witherspoon neighborhood, this was their community center. Of course, much activity took place in the churches, but this was the community center. And Doretta, you know and I know how valuable the Loft Theater's floor was to what we were doing, because dancers loved that floor. It was a sprung wooden floor. Why? Because it was the basketball court for the African-American young men who played basketball.
I'm going to interject. Mm-hmm. That floor is so amazing that I had a flamenco teacher come to me and say she has to go to New York City to find a floor like that. She couldn't believe that was there.
Well, it's in the renovation of the building, which comes much later, they didn't touch the floor, right. Thank God. So this was the community center, right. Because the Y, which might have been, it was only down the street, was segregated. Because it was segregated, the United Way helped to support the Arts Council as a community center. They supported it financially. The United Way. But in the 60s, along with school desegregation in Princeton, there were some do-gooders, I guess you could say, who decided, no, the Y can no longer be segregated. So it became integrated, and in fact, one of the members, prominent members of the community, Susie Waxwood, became one of the directors of the Y. When that integration happened of the Y, the United Way pulled its funding from the Arts Council, and it fell into disrepair because the community couldn't support it.
Right.
Financially, they could not support it. It became shuttered, glass broken. It was an abandoned building.
Mm-hmm.
And to bring us up to the point that you and I really want to talk mm-hmm. about, the borough, at that time, we had two towns, the borough and the town. It was in the borough, and the borough government said to some people who were interested in culture and the arts, if you want that building, they had already started an arts council, but it was sort of in the borough hall. If you want that building, give us a dollar and it's yours. The Arts Council moved in, took over, created a performance space, rehearsal space, art gallery, art making rooms.
Mm-hmm.
It was rough, but it was viable. Then the ADA laws were passed, the federal ADA laws. And, of course, the Arts Council was relying on grants. On the ADA laws, I think we're in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, or maybe mid-70s, I think.
I think so. Yeah. You're right. It was, of course, before we started.
Well before.
There, well before.
But every institution had a length of time that they needed in order to develop this the buildings.
Well, bring it up to code.
In order to bring it up to code, they had, of course, put in elevators. And they realized, the Board of Trustees realized at that time, that to put in elevators would eat up one-third of the building. So they couldn't have a viable building with elevators. What to do? Let's expand. And this is really where our story begins.
Right.
Because Doretta and I came to the Arts Council in the midst of this planning on the part of the Board of Trustees for expansion.
That's right.
You were not supposed to be part of that, your job, right?
Exactly. My role was internal management and operations, like I'd said. I wasn't the voice of the community. I wasn't the face of the community. There was an executive director still there, still operating that way. And there was enough to do with keeping
right.
that place running
right.
to not be involved. That was my role initially. but then we'll talk about how that changed. But for you, Janet, you were doing programming.
And I had an obligation to report to the borough every year on activities that we arranged and created for the neighbors, because that was one of the stipulations in giving the building to the Arts Council, that the neighbors had to be part of it. Before me, the Board of Trustees would go to the borough once a year, to the council, to the municipal borough council, and talk about the activities. But they never actually said to the borough, nothing's working, the neighbors aren't coming.
I always put words in your mouth, but I think what I remember from before you started, because I think I was there a year or two before you started, it was very superficial. Everything was lovely. Everything was wonderful. Rose-colored glasses. Mm-hmm. They love us.
Right. They love us.
And I didn't know any better at the time, not having the history.
Right.
And then when Janet started, the programs, things changed.
Well, I don't want to talk about myself. I mean, I did start things like a Martin Luther King Day program and things like that. And I did try very hard because it was my job. I would probably not get a good performance review if I didn't do this, so it was my job. So I'm not trying to say that I did this on my own, you know, power. Partly, but not exactly. So I would go to the borough council every year, and I would read a list of all the things that I organized that year. And then they would say, and how was the attendance? And I would say, zero. And instead of their being angry or annoyed, they were sorry for me. Because they knew that we really were putting this work into it, but the neighbors weren't coming. Why? Because they hated us.
And we didn't
realize
that.
They hated us.
Right.
They looked at us with, you are interlopers. That is our building. Mm-hmm. How dare you? Why would they come? Mm-hmm. And this is what we were up against. When the borough... When the Arts Council Board of Trustees decided to expand, one of the things they wanted to do is to build a theater. Anybody listening to this recording must know how tight the space is on that corner. There was an older parking lot that's no longer there, but it wasn't very big. The theater would be on that, looming over the next door neighbor's house, which was probably 10 feet away. That is not exactly an invitation to approval from a neighborhood whose concerns were obviously going to be elicited by the planning board when this came to pass. And I didn't say, Doretta, was this when Michael Graves was hired to design?
Yes. By the time I was brought on, the building plan was already designed, and it was basically, this is what we're doing.
Okay.
I don't know. Maybe you could expand on this. Do you know if any solicitation happened from the neighbors in making that plan?
Not in the plan, because everybody assumed in a kind of benighted way that if you get Michael Graves, everything is fine. Michael Graves, this was about, I would say this was probably about the mid-90s that he was asked if he would do this, and he did it. He did the design pro bono, but the actual construction and everything wasn't. But I do want to reiterate, and I'm not blaming anybody, but there is this sense here that if you get someone famous, you're fine. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to object. Who would object? Michael Graves, one of the most famous architects in American architectural history. Who would object? But so at that point, Doretta, no, there were no soliciting. That's a good question. No, I don't think at that point there was any.
Because I believe, tell me what you think, I believe a lot more animosity than happened because of why wouldn't it?
Right.
We're shoving something on people. Right.
Exactly.
And it was shoved on us, too, when we think about it, you know.
Someone on the board of trustees must have heard that they had better start getting buy-in from the neighbors or this might have trouble before the planning board. So they started to arrange meetings. This was done, and I don't want to sound like I'm full of vindictiveness, this was done in good faith, I would say, on the part of the board. They thought, okay, we'll do that. Yes, the neighbors should speak up. Yes. So they started to arrange meetings at the various black churches. There were four at that time. And at every meeting, it was ugly. So ugly that it made the New York Times. One of our very, very, very generous and hardworking board members, who we both think the world of, was told at one of these meetings by one of the neighbors, "I want to cut your throat out." That quote got into the New York Times. This was awful. And what I really wanted, one of the things I really want to say here, because it has a bearing on what I want to say at the end of this, is what they were doing was setting up a them and us. And when you do them and us, it's not going to go well. We're seeing this every day now in our own political situation. This was them and us. It wasn't anyone meeting one-on-one, figuring out what are your real concerns. It was en masse.
Exactly. Just to interject, what I felt was because they didn't get some more buy-in initially, there was no team that came together. There was no decision about what we could do in the building to make it. It was just, here you go.
Right.
Here it is.
This is it. This is it for you. Michael Graves.
It could have been the perfect spot, the perfect situation, and they still wouldn't have bought. They still would have balked at it.
Right. And Doretta, you reminded me that this wasn't a good plan anyway, because why? The theater would have taken all the resources?
Right. So a lot of things about the plan that I objected to, and I think there were some board members that quietly did, you know, as well. But I came from an organization that had a theater. And during their capital campaign, they were taking the theater out because of the costs to maintain it. I didn't see anything that showed me that there was any thought in how do we keep this running, and was there a need in the community for it. I had a very bad feeling that this was going to be a big, big black hole after a while. So from that point of view, I wasn't comfortable with the plan. And the other thing was, there wasn't anything going to be done to repair the building,
which was a mess.
The money was going into getting a naming opportunity for the new theater and naming opportunities for this, that, and the other thing. But naming opportunities, those are, if a donor gives you a substantial amount of money, then their name will be put on, in this case, let's say, the theater. If you give us $5 million, the theaters at, or for example, the Sands, the library where we are right now, that was Sands had given a lot of money.
You can also name seats in the
right.
theater. On the back of the seat, you may see a plaque or.
Exactly.
And we had that.
We had all of that. But the things that was the bread and butter of the Arts Council that was really keeping it running and running well and being a service to the community were its classes and its programs. And we were woefully, inadequately. We had nothing. The facilities were woefully inadequate.
But no money was going to that.
The only thing that was going to be for the building, if I recall, was they were going to paint. They were going to paint the inside. But we were going to run ceramics classes with four wheels, you know, and that was it. I could never take one more student because, you know. So financially, we're always strapped. And we were sharing spaces, so one minute there was a dance group, everything had to be put away, and then the singing group would come in, and it was a very, very difficult space to manage, and there was a lot of repair. We were getting water in the basement, we were getting water in our storage areas, there was asbestos, it was an old WPA building that needed to be refurbished.
We think that... I've been on the board. I was on the board for 9 years. And so my sense was that what the board was envisioning were galas in the theater space. It would be beautiful. It would have chandeliers. It would have this. It would be a place where companies could come and have their company gatherings, and that would make money to probably subsidize the things that you're talking about, Doretta.
They were thinking and hoping. Let's talk a little bit about what happened at the at these meetings and the meetings
were ugly, and no attention was paid to what the neighbors were saying, because the neighbors were so angry. And so very easy to discount them. Well, they're angry, you know. The planning board meeting finally comes. I think this is the early 2000s, maybe 2002. I'm not quite sure if it's 2000 or 2002. And it goes before the planning board. This goes to like 12 or 1 in the morning, because many people on the planning board also are on the borough council, and they are very sensitive to what the neighbors feel. The line for the neighbors at the microphone to speak that night practically went out of the building. It was one horrible diatribe after another. And you could see the planning board, they were sweating. To make a long story short, they got to the very last, they finally took a vote after midnight, and it got to be 5-5. There was one more person to vote, and it was Wendy Benchley, the wife of Peter Benchley, who wrote Jaws. She was an extraordinarily conscientious councilwoman and planning board member, and she was almost dying up there. She could not decide what to do. She thought it would be good for Princeton, but not good for the community. And she voted no, at 6-5.
Right.
Well, at that point, the Board of Trustees decided, well, we'll take this elsewhere.
Right.
They don't want us, we'll go elsewhere. Started to look around Hopewell and decided that there was a farm out there. But you didn't think that was a good idea, Doretta.
No, I didn't. But actually, Janet, you convinced me, because I was starting to, like, you know, buy in a little bit about, well, we can't build here, and this is a big space. Maybe we could make it work. And I remember you and I went out to see the facility, and on our way back, we were driving together. And in the car, you were expressing to me how upset you were about how it would take the Arts Council out of the community, away from the neighbors, away from the kids, away from the ability to offer scholarships to get them to come to classes. We would have to deal with busing. And just the mission was lost. And it was your voice, and I listened to you, and that's when I went back and wrote up a plan on how to redesign the building.
Well, we had a meeting with the board, with members of the board. I remember this. We had a meeting. It was a summer day. We sat there with members of the board and enumerated all the other theaters in town.
That's right.
Berlin had come up, built not too much in advance of that. Westminster Choir College had a brand new theater. The high school just built a 700-seat auditorium. And we went over and over. We said, this is not what we do. This is not our niche. Our niche is what you described before, Doretta, the classes, the performance, the rehearsals for small groups that have nowhere else to go. That was our niche. Not a big gala mm-hmm. theater. Everywhere else has that. And so they listened.
They finally said,
okay, no theater.
The problem was then, we talked earlier about the naming opportunity. The theater was already named. Money had already been taken. A lot of money had come in this big capital campaign. And all of a sudden was like, uh-oh, now what? We don't want to give the money back. And we do need to do something about this building. It's not ADA compliant. And thankfully, we put our heads together and came up with a new way to look at the building, to improve the space, and to have a new plan. But, and we really have to touch on this, Janet, that was not an easy sell either.
No.
And that's when we talk about Princeton Futures a little bit and about Mr. Kostenbach.
So what happened was that the neighbors were still not happy. And so we took it upon ourselves to try to persuade them to come in and just see the place, to just try to talk with us in small groups. But Princeton Futures, which was an organization, I think it's still running, at that time thought of it itself as a fixer. And it was run by a man who thought, well, we'll just get everyone together, all of the stakeholders, and we'll meet. And so they had three people from the neighborhood, three people from the Arts Council, Doretta, me, and our new board of trustees, the new chair, who was terrific,
mm-hmm.
I thought.
Yeah.
And three people from the community, not the neighbors, one of whom, in that incessant need to have somebody famous was Nicholas Katzenbach, who had been the Attorney General under Johnson, the Deputy Attorney General under Robert Kennedy. But because he was Nicholas Katzenbach, he was barely living at this point. Yes. But no, they wanted Nicholas Katzenbach, so he was going to come in and join the fray. He was the one who stood up to George Wallace in the schoolhouse door. This was Nicholas Katzenbach. So he obviously had a lot of empathy for African Americans. And so this was with a nine, and it was so painful that, Doretta, you and I started calling it the Gang of Nine.
Right.
Every time we would meet, it was an opportunity for the three neighbors to scream at us and yell at us and tell us what we were doing wrong, why we didn't understand anything, why this whole thing was so egregious, and then to charge Doretta, charge you, mm-hmm. with making reports. So you'd go home at night and write tables and charts and reports and who does this and who... Next meeting, that wasn't good enough. You got to go and write more reports. Mm-hmm. So you got sick. Mm-hmm. You actually got physically sick.
Well, because I wasn't hired to do anything. I was still running an operation.
Right. Anyway, the Gang of Nine ended at a meeting on campus. And to this day, I cannot remember why it was on campus. However, I did skip over one thing. Something really, really, really important happened, and this goes back to our decision about not having a them and us situation. Doretta, you and I became friends with a woman in the neighborhood, a young woman who was a very active person and young. Asked her to join the Board of Trustees, which she did, and she was terrific. Her mother said to her, who she still lives in the neighborhood, her mother said to her, you know, there's a person in the neighborhood who has a lot of photos, hundreds of thousands of photos of the neighborhood. I'm not going to mention names, but we could make a quilt with those photos if you can get them to agree, if you can get and get other women in the neighborhood to work on it. This person who had all these photos, she inherited them from her father, she's a very well-known person in the neighborhood, was at this meeting on campus. I wanted to approach her, but I was terrified of her. She never smiled. She intimidated me. She was extraordinarily revered, for good reason. And at this meeting on campus with Nicholas Katzenbach and everybody else, we talked about all the things we tried to do.
Right.
And they listened. Mm-hmm. They listened. They did listen. And at the end of the meeting, we were nearly in tears.
Well, actually, we were. I remember leaving that meeting, and we basically...
Well, before we left,
we collapsed.
I went over to this woman. I was terrified. My heart was beating, and I said, I have an idea, or we have... I did give credit to our friend's mother about a quilt using your photos. May I pursue that with you? And she looked up at me, no smile, but there was the slightest little nod. And that did it. We came out of there crying, but at that point I started walking up and down the streets of the neighborhood, talking to people on their porches. Would you like to help with this? Would you like to? I ended up getting four women who would do it, and a quilter, who was also African American. And they liked her. And that was the origin of the neighborhood quilt.
That's right.
We had when it was finished, we had a big signing where all the people in the neighborhood came in to sign their names over the pictures of their ancestors and their family members who were in these pictures. It was very successful. We had a big brunch, everything. It was heartwarming. And the quilt still hangs. It's faded now, but it still hangs. But I think the lesson of that for me, and I think this is where I think we went right, mm-hmm. is to take it away from them and us, and to see what a one-on-one relationship can mean and can do.
I agree. I think as well is we found you have to take a step back and you have to find creative solutions if they're even possible. And the quilt definitely, it was a bridge. And I know one other thing that I'll mention is when you were struggling so much to to run these programs and have people come into the Arts Council, and they weren't coming. And I remember I was on your case about it because you offered, like, they were always free, and they never brought in any money,
right.
And I always had to report to the board that why we were in the hole. And so, but then one thing that I found was I decided instead of asking them to come to us, we should go to them.
Right.
So
which
I started.
Was key.
I got a grant from the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, started running programs in their learning centers, in the nursery school, bringing the Arts Council classes, programs, teachers, experience to them. And then eventually, I mean, we can't speak to after we left, but there was a point there where they were well attended. We could say hello to people.
Right.
It wasn't a horrible situation.
Dance groups from the churches rehearsed there.
Right.
You had this alignment with PYA, Princeton
right.
Young Achievers, and you took art classes to them.
One thing that I will say, I lost my train of thought, but is there was such such lack of trust. I don't remember at that meeting that you talked about on campus, I do remember somebody saying, well, it all sounds good what you're saying,
okay.
And you seem like people who really do care and want to do something right, but what happens when you leave? And I think that just hit me really hard because I thought there's such a lack of trust and there were so many broken promises
mm-hmm.
that they have been so wounded.
Right.
And I believe that as horrible it was to be on the receiving end, they're lashing out at us, which is really what they did.
It was justified.
It didn't help my psyche, but it was justified.
And I think that the end of the story is it went back before the planning board. There was very little neighborhood opposition, and it passed without the theater.
But I believe, I agree, and how you feel about this, but there seemed to be, and I don't want to speak for people who aren't here, seem to be a little bit more listening
right.
towards the end. I hope the neighbors, I hope the neighbors now are using the facility. I hope they go there.
Mm-hmm.
I hope they didn't feel like it was shoved down their throats. Certainly the building that is there now is much smaller in footprint than what was originally planned. And that's just my hope.
Right.
How about you, Janet?
The same. I think they probably are coming. I think so. The Arts Council, after we left, always, I think, kept this in mind, what happened. And so I think that's a good place to leave our discussion.
Thank you again for your time. This is the end of the recording.